Ciao bella, and welcome to the Cannon Fodder Podcast. I'm your paisan, Daniel Barnes. Am I your paisan? With me, as always, is my paisan. He's a quirky McDonald.
Hey, everybody. In the immortal words of Tupac, all pies on me, huh?
Classic.
How you doing, Dan?
By Mr. Quirky McDonald. Oh, you know, I'm hanging in there. How about
yeah.
you?
Yeah. Me paisan ultimo. Paisan
ultimo. Is that, that just means last, right? I'm the last paisan.
You're my last paisan. That's that actually sounds paisan. Like a mafia movie.
The last really paisan. It does. Yeah, you know, so we're here daylight savings time.
Oh happened. Boy.
Boy, I hate daylight savings time.
Do you? Really I do. Love it.
I really hate it. It's just like all of a sudden, it's just dark. All of a sudden. Like, we can't even just gradually get into it. You know, you can't just, like, make it be a little bit darker. It was already getting a little darker. And then all of a sudden, they're just like, no. Pitch black.
I love it because without daylight savings time, it would be the extended time period this time of year where driving west in Northern California, anytime between 5 and 6 p.m.
Oh, that's for sure.
You're just.
You're blinded.
You're going by luck. You're going by vibes. Yeah. It's like, all right, let's see what happens. I cannot see anything in front of me.
Sutterville, the Sutterville Bridge near my street where it goes up while you're heading west. I mean, you're going up and west. I mean, like, you cannot not stare at the sun. And it's just like, I hope there's no one in the road.
Right I really sincerely I hope right? no one's like, running in front, just standing turning right in front.
So, and people do that on the Sutterville Bridge all the time. So there's
without that, it would be a catastrophe for even longer.
I agree. Speaking of catastrophes, boy, World War II.
You know,
just rough times, rough sledding is, I think, what the kids say.
Yes, kids, not
kids and sledding.
Area. Kids are always talking about sledding and World War II.
Sleigh bells, sledding, World War II. Yeah, partisans in the Po, constantly going on about their paisans.
Are you a World War II buff?
I'm not a buff. I've never buffed, sir.
Any military buffing?
No. I challenge you to show me any evidence that I have ever buffed. Any video or audio of me expressing a pro buff viewpoint, sir. I would not buff. Nor would I chamois. the squeak test does not apply to me. Are you a buff? What buff? What buffs? What wars do you buff?
Oh well, when I turned, I'd say 35, it just all of a sudden I became very interested in battles, like learning.
Wow, really?
I was like, okay, well, I'm a cishet man. I guess this is the appropriate time where this kicks in your body naturally. Right?
Like the testosterone is starting to dip, and all of a sudden the World War II just kind of comes up and takes its place.
Yeah, you start study. You all of a sudden know what a pincer movement is. You study battle plans. You know the Schlieffen plan for some godly reason.
I don't know the Schlieffen plan.
Oh, that's from the Great War.
That's the Great War. Oh, well, yeah. Shit. Yeah.
I mean, all of this goes back to the assassination of the Archduke Franz Ferdinand. I mean, that's the pinpoint, the linchpin for everything.
Yeah, doesn't it? And yet, this film that we're about to review, acts like that doesn't even happen. It's not even a factor in their totally world. It's like, wow, just rare air that you're in.
So, any military historians listening right now, hey, you got a friend and you got a paisan in us. I'll tell you that.
This is classic banter.
Before we talk about the movie today, we're going to do this. We're going to say thank you to all our PayPal supporters. Our donors, they are the heroes of the show. They are true paisans, true amici. We couldn't do it without you, and we thank you so much for your support.
And if you would like to join their August ranks and donate to the show, head over to daredaniel.com. Go to the menu at the top of the page, click support the show. There's also a donate button there on the homepage. You can make a one-time donation, a two-time donation, a 300-time donation. Well, there's no limits on the amount or frequency of donations that I've ever heard of. Any contribution, though, Even a dollar or a few dollars or $5, any contribution really helps keep the show going. We depend on you guys to help us make this show happen every 2 weeks.
And now, Paisan. The IMDb synopsis for Paisan: American military personnel interact warily with a variety of Italian locals over a year and a half in the push north during the Italian campaign of World War II as German forces make their retreat.
Yes, this week's film, it's A Paisan, directed by Roberto Rossellini, pieced together from stories by several different writers, including Federico Fellini, Amarcor, episode 38, anyway. It's an anthology of 6 episodes that ostensibly tracks the Allied path of victory through Italy late in World War II, but the mood within these individual episodes is not one of victory and heroism necessarily, but of usually bitter defeat. They tend to end suddenly, tragically, and or ironically, not just simple tales of heroism in a Roberto Rossellini film. He might be best known today for his involvement with Ingrid Bergman and the controversy that caused at the time, but he was also a celebrated filmmaker, don't you know? And here with Paisan, he was coming off the big success of Rome Open City, Roma Città Aperta, widely considered the keystone Italian neorealist movie, and a hit, too. Mm-hmm. It was a hit, even overseas. He was able to make this film with some American investors, some American actors, and a much larger scope and scale, while still staying true to this blending of documentary and very realistic narrative that he established with Open City. Paisan premiered at the Venice Film Festival in September 1946, released in Italy December 10, 1946, played in America in a truncated version about 90 minutes long. It was somewhat controversial in the homeland, but widely celebrated otherwise. Did pretty well at the box office to boot, and it was nominated for a Best Original Screenplay Oscar in 1949, losing to Battleground, which is another World War II movie. And it won the New York Film Critics Circle Award for Best Foreign Film. It is tied for 196th best film of all time on the 2022 Sight and Sound Critics Poll. It's one of 3 Rossellini films that made the list. Open City, not among them, kind of surprisingly. The two of the ones he made with Ingrid Bergman, Europa 51, and then Journey to Italy is the highest ranking, his 1954 film, tied at number 72. But then Paisan back at number 196. So quirky.
Yeah.
We dipped our toe into Italian neorealism way back in like episode 3 or 4, whatever that was, with The Bicycle Thief. And we both absolutely loved that film. I think that's one of the favorite for both of us of all the movies that we'd reviewed. So here we have kind of a different take on it. You know, De Sica, there's always an element of comedy, really, in his films, and I think there isn't one here, or at least there's that kind of simple humanity of De Sica. This is a little more severe. What did you think of it? How did you feel it compared to Bicycle Thief, and just how did you like it overall?
Well, I think it pales in comparison to Bicycle Thieves, but I think the majority of films do.
But, I mean, I guess that's not fair.
I saw it doing the same things that Bicycle Things does with the neorealism, being shot in and amongst rubble and destitute conditions, and then using non-actors in a large portion of the cast, and what are quite obviously radio actors who did not know how to be on screen, but had great voices.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm thinking of the priests.
Obviously, like, dubbed in almost every scene as well. Yeah. There's extensive dubbing going on.
So I didn't know what to expect with it, and I think it bookends fantastically. Those were, I think, the best parts of this movie. And it's not canon-worthy for me. I'm really interested to hear your opinions, and I'm really interested in kind of learning a little bit more about why it's considered so groundbreaking. It's interesting in that it's not happy at all. Like, there's no... At the time, you would think that they're coming out of World War II, there might be this kind of, like, catharsis, like, let's get a win in here somewhere. There's none of that. And the Paizan is almost kind of ironic because it's more the differences that ruin these people's lives. And there's never any kind of friendship. It's just like we're in and amongst each other. We're counting on each other, but then we're butting heads all the time.
Yeah, it's a very uneasy alliance, and there's a lot of confusion caused by language. We see how there's all these things like language, same with religion, I think, same with rich versus poor or black versus white. All these things that divide us can connect us, but very often divide us and with very tragic results in this setting.
Yeah. The other thing that took me, and kind of leads into the whole communication or trouble understanding, was the tone of the movie varies very wildly from segment to segment. It's six segments of wartime stories. And the first one, like I said, banger. The second one, they're good stories, but they just the tone kind of drags or pulls you down from investing in characters.
Yeah, I mean, I pretty much agree with everything you're saying. I mean, I think the movie's fascinating, and I did like it overall, and it's one that is sort of sticking with me as I'm thinking about it more. It's kind of growing a little bit, but I agree, not canon-worthy. I loved how authentic it felt. I mean, like, when they're walking through, like, rubble, it's not production design rubble, right? Like, the slums are the slums. Like, this is not like, oh, wow, what set decoration? No, that's what a country that loses a world war a year ago looks like. It's rubble, right? Like, it's just poor and poverty everywhere you go. And I loved the different perspectives. And what I think is, like, most fascinating, what I'm still carrying with me from this movie is that, like, there's this counterpoint going on between, like, we have this sort of documentary part where we're introduced to each episode by, like, here's what's happening on the larger scale, right? Like, episode one, the Allies have landed in Sicily. The Allies are making their move to liberate Italy, and it's starting on the very, very, very southern tip. And if you map it, like, I actually did go and Google, because I'm not a geography expert or anything like that. This six episodes, they do form this path from Sicily all straight up all the way to, like, nearly to the border of France.
That's right.
We end up at the Po River there. Yeah, they're going, like, this is an actual march. There's an actual progression to it. And if you just looked at that kind of intro, those six intros to it, right? Like, it's a string of victories, right? Like, we're tracking victory. We've started with making, head on Sicily, going up through what's next, Naples, and then Rome, liberating Rome, and then Florence, and then Rimini, and then finally all the way up to the Po Delta up there in northern Italy. So it's the story of victory, right, and liberation and all of these things. But within the stories themselves are filled with defeatism and despair and just, like, no sentimentality or anything like that. So that's what I found really, really interesting about it. And it kind of forms these, like, unheard, untold stories of war. People just lost to history, right? At the very end, there's this group of soldiers. They're sitting around realizing they're dead, right? They've been captured by the Nazis. They're dead. And one of them says, like, my family will never know what happened to me, And to me, that's like the meaning of this film, is all of these stories of people who die because of a misunderstanding, and whose stories, or who are just lost, who are in the river, who are underground, who are blown up, who are whatever. And so I think that, to me, is what worked. I did find it kind of dreary at times, and I agree. The episodes are not they're not consistently good. I thought there were two episodes that I really actually just didn't care for at all, which was the second one that you mentioned with the drunk soldier, and then the next to last one with the chaplains and the monks. I thought those were both kind of dreary to me. I appreciated the brutality of it, which must have been somewhat shocking at the time. And it's not presented in a way of, like, here's some shock value brutality. I mean, it's just, like, it's quick, like, the violence is fast. It is like you're alive 1 second and then you're not alive anymore.
Yeah.
Right? Like that light is just gone. And that's how fast it happens. And then how pitiless it is and how unstylized it is. So I absolutely loved that. I love the documentary realism. I love the lack of sentimentality. I even think in the most sentimental seemingly episode, or potentially, which is the Chaplain and the Monks episode, the ending of that, I feel, we could talk about it as we go through the episodes, even that feels sort of tinged with a bitter sort of an irony
to it. I agree.
The final speech that he gives, even though it's very much praising of them, I feel there is like an irony to that. But again, yeah, I just, even compared to Open City and certainly compared to Bicycle Thief, but I just think generally compared to a lot of other war films that, you know, we've seen, this is really good, fascinating stuff. I love that I saw it, but yeah, I just don't see it as like a canon level film.
I'm the same. Good movie. Glad I watched it. There's some good,
very good movie.
Yeah,
the ambition is fantastic to tell all these different stories.
Yeah.
So let's go through the episodes just a little bit briefly. So episode one, none of these have titles or any kind of intertitles or anything. We're just kind of, they're given shape by, again, this narration, this sort of documentary narration. We see this like kind of stock footage or documentary footage of, you know, tanks rolling along and soldiers coming in and, you know, all these kind of thing. Episode one, I called The Soldier and the Girl, although I think like three or four of these could be called The Soldier and the Girl, but really The Soldiers and the Girl, I guess, which is that the Americans have landed. They're looking around for any Germans who might be kind of left in this tiny little village in Sicily. They find a girl who they're going to help have them help guide them. And again, this is like these sort of series of, you know, sudden happenings or like misunderstandings. So like, these two, this American soldier and this girl, and he's just trying to like kind of warm her up a little bit. She's like, you know, she doesn't want to be there. She wants to get out. He's talking to her, and in doing so, he briefly lights a match and is immediately shot. Like immediately shot. It's so sudden and so shocking. He's just done. He's gone. And this causes this like misunderstanding where she could run, but she actually goes back for him. But then the American soldiers who eventually come for her think that she was the one who killed him, but they find that we find that she was actually even more brutally murdered by the Nazis themselves.
Yeah. After she shoots at them.
Yes, exactly.
And she decides like, I'm going to go out. Cause it's very brutal. Like the Nazis are casually discussing what they're going to do with this young woman.
Yes.
And,
yes.
You know, and it's just, it's casual conversation and she knows what's going to happen. And she didn't want to be there, but the American can't understand her saying that in Italian. It's just, you have all this different language going on. Nobody can speak to each other, but everybody's got missions and she can't live her own free life that she wants to, because while not being like, they're not occupying like the Nazis, he's got his orders and he's like, no, you can't leave. You know, like,
exactly.
It's a fucked up situation all around.
Yeah, but it was she wants to go and look for her family.
Yeah.
It's like her father and brother, I think she said, are missing.
Probably dead.
But again, they can't really understand her either because they only, a couple of them actually speak any Italian whatsoever. So yeah, it kind of sets this theme of like trying to connect, you know, people from different cultures and different languages and people who are ostensibly on the same side, trying to make some kind of connection and it not really working out for them.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, and a tragic, like misunderstanding.
To the detriment of everyone we meet.
Yes, absolutely. So yeah, that's a really good first episode.
Right?
I didn't like this one. Oh, it's great. Yeah. But episode two was not as great.
No.
This one is a bunch of kind of, you know, artful dodger little boys.
Yep.
In Naples, and there's a drunk soldier who's getting rolled, a black soldier.
Like, they're all fighting to take advantage of this guy.
Yes, exactly. And the kid actually doesn't take advantage of him, although once he falls asleep, he does steal his shoes. But then the soldier, like, follows him and sees how poor he is, and it's, you know, I don't know, the sentimentality of it. I mean, it's just like, how well did Roberto Rossellini understand, like, what it's like for a black man in America at this time.
There was something that was trying to be said about it, because he said, he's like, I don't want to go home. Like, he's bragging about all the great shit he's going to, and then he's like, I don't even really want to go home. And it's like, I think he got it there. It's like, this is a guy who's fighting for his country. He's about to go back to a country where he doesn't have the same rights as everybody. Mm-hmm. There's also a Punch and Judy show that they go and see, and it's the story of Moors being fought in Italy, in Sicily. So there's some kind of level of understanding of an African-American man over there. But it doesn't connect the way it should.
Yeah, I agree. It's just off, right?
Yeah.
Like, it's just, I don't know if the attempts at comedy or what, it's just, it doesn't work. Episode 3, you could also call The Soldier and the Girl. The soldier's drunk again, like he was in episode 2. Different soldier, white soldier. This is like the most kind of, I don't want to say Hollywood, because this is very tragic, but I mean, the plot of this is a slightly similar to Waterloo Bridge, which is about a soldier who gets amnesia and this woman becomes a prostitute. It's very similar to that, movie that had been made a couple times by this point.
Even the kind of stunt casting of having the woman play both the sweetheart that he meets and the prostitute, that takes it out of the neo-realism kind of angle that
she's the same person as we find out.
It wasn't the same person?
It was. And she tried to, that's like the bitter irony of this one, which is that like he's gone looking for this woman who he met. And again, like this is like the victory turning to defeat, like souring so quickly, right? The opening of this is they liberated Rome. They liberated really the biggest city in Italy. They liberated it. And everyone loved them. And he has this story about this girl that he met just after they came into the city. And he went back to try to find her, and he couldn't find her. But him and the prostitute find each other. She's now a prostitute, because that's how well things have gone, you know, in the aftermath of this liberation. So it is like this really bitter, bitter irony to the story that he does find her, but she's a prostitute. She actually says, like, here it is. Take this. Go there. I'll be there. I'll be ready. I'll be my old self again. And he just says, this is a prostitute's address, and throws it away. I mean, it's pretty fucking brutal. And she's just left there once again, alone, waiting for this guy, waiting for the promise that was, you know, carried over when the Americans came into Rome. So I did really like this episode 3 as well. Episode 4 was, a little bit of a mixed bag for me. Pacing was a bit off in this one, but it was really interesting in that it was touched a little more on just like kind of regular people kind of living with war.
Yeah. You know,
like here it is, right? It's just right here. Like they go up to the roof and there's the guy who was a World War I veteran who's tracking all the movements of the soldiers and criticizing some of the strategies and things like that. But it's just like, here it is. There's war happening in my neighborhood. There it is over there, you know? It's basically about these two people trying to cross the lines and get to people on the other side.
And it's about also the occupying forces and how they view this as some place of sightseeing almost. The Italian people are like, we've dealt with this for centuries of invading people coming up and down our country. We have hidden ways of travel. Everybody knows these ways. You outsiders don't, but we know them. And we can get around the city even in the worst of times.
Absolutely. Yeah. It ends very suddenly and very tragically, and there's no real like satisfaction or payoff or anything to it.
I didn't connect with the people really.
No, so. It didn't either. They're all just trying to get back to their people. They have, I mean, I guess, you know, it's like everyone has their reasons. Like, okay, you're fighting your war, but I have to do, like, I have a thing I need to do, and I need to, there's people counting on me. Episode 5, again, one of my least favorite episodes, along with episode 2, the chaplains and the monk. So this is kind of a little away from the fighting. It's west of Rimini, which is way over on the eastern coast of Italy. And essentially it's this, you know, monastery where the monks have been completely cut off, or the monks, the Catholic, fucking up my religion. The Catholics, they've all just been cut off from this. They've been really kind of sheltered from what's been going on, from the fighting and everything like that. They're just growing their gardens and saying their prayers and all this stuff. And then these three American chaplains, army chaplains, come in. And it's a big controversy because, yes, there is one Catholic, but there's also a Protestant and a Jew. And there's a lot of kind of like dumb attempts at comedy around like the monks being, or the, just being like, oh, Jew, oh my God. Again, I feel like this one, as I think about it some more, I don't think it's as straightforward as I first was kind of like, oh boy, yeah, yeah. As I think like, the monks or the Catholics all come to the one Catholic chaplain and say, like, how can you be with these people? Like, you have to convert them, basically, right? Like, you have to, it's wrong of you to not do this. And the chaplain is like, ah, I don't do that. You know, that's not what we do, right? Like, it's just that's not a cool thing to do. He's trying to talk to them in a very sensible way. And they're reacting like people who live in a fucking monastery don't have any idea of what's going on out in the world. But then at the very end, they're fasting, and they're maybe I read it wrong, but they're doing it in a way that is very like literally holier than
that. It's very guilty.
Literally holier than that. Like, we're gonna fast.
Oh no,
so
you
will
eat.
Get into heaven, and you guys eat. Go ahead and eat.
We're
we'll
just gonna
eat.
Not eat because there's two lost souls enjoying our food.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And then the chaplain gets up and you think like, okay, well, he's going to make a speech really giving these guys what for, but he does the opposite. He says, thank you so much. Like, I found such peace here. I found such, and again, I feel like, well, I certainly don't agree with it. You know, I really wish he did give them what for, but at the same time, it's kind of like, okay, well, like, you can't expect, what's this guy's story, right? Like, he's been through war and he's here finding peace. He's talking to people about Catholicism and its meaning and its significance and how, what, you know, in ways that he probably hasn't for years, you know,
so, or ever, or could ever even possibly be, because at the start of that segment, he's taking great pains to say that this building that we're about to go into has been around since America was, you know, discovered.
Right.
So it is so old that what they do here is beyond our understanding of this, of my religion. Right. So it's, again, the paisan, the whole, like, different cultures and the way they do what you would think is a common thing, the different ways they do it. The American Catholics and these devout, weirdo fucking monks.
Yeah. I mean, I guess, the paisan is almost kind of ironic as well, right? Because it's not just a straight friendship. It's more like, we need each other.
Yeah.
You know, just because of how, I mean, because, like, what's the... The alternative is like Mussolini and Hitler, and you know what I mean? So, like, yeah, we need each other. You need us. We need you. But we don't understand each other. Like, we don't understand our language. We don't understand the culture. We don't understand, like, who you are or what you want or what your life
motivations.
Is like. Exactly. Yeah. So, I think that paisan is a little bit,
absolutely
as well.
I agree.
And then finally, episode 6, leave them laughing. I always say, partisans. Partisans in the Poe, and this is like probably the most brutal one, and certainly the ending is incredibly brutal and just like pitiless, you know, very unsentimental. But basically, we just open with like a dead body floating down the Poe River. It's a partisan. He has a sign attached to him that says partisan, and it's obvious that this is like a message being sent. And they just want to get the body out of the river, right? And so, but this is a case where it's like the OSS, people are working behind enemy lines, but then there's also the partisans who are doing their own things, and then there's also like another army that's not the recognized army, you know? So it's just, there's all these different armies, different, you know, soldiers and different people who aren't soldiers and things like that going on back there, trying to like get along with each other. And then it, of course, ends really poorly. And then that final scene of just dumping the bodies in the Poe with their hands all tied up, and they just, you know, disappear in the river and disappear to history, right? Just like so many of the other people who we've seen in this film. no one will remember them. No one will even know what happened to them or how they died or who killed them or where. And the Americans are immediately gunned down as soon as they see what's happening as well. So
this,
and
was,
again, this is like the, you want the bitter irony. I mean, this is like, this all comes right after this smug Nazi gives a speech about how, you know, the German victory is inevitable and they must destroy the world to remake it and the perfect and everything like that. And this is just months before the war is all over, right?
Yeah.
So it's like these the Germans, the Nazis are taking victory laps and talking about how great it's going to be. And it's like, you're done. Like, you're done. Like, it's over. You know, like, it's, we're in endgame here.
Yeah.
So there's that irony as well. So, yeah, it's...
This was my favorite segment, and it's not because, like, this is the most action-packed. There's that segment of running through... the city and trying to get back to your family. That's pretty action packed, but this is like action. There is action, but it was because it was the fog of war kind of murkiness of it. You got the OSS, the, you know, the pre-runner of the CIA behind enemy lines. It's fucking an Apocalypse Now mission off the books. They're just running. They don't have orders. They're just trying to kill as many and keep supplies, information chains open. The partisans, they operate, they live off the land, they work in the land. Everything is just in this murky world in the marshes where you don't see somebody, but you're in the water with them in the reeds. They're hiding right behind you. And it's like a Fargo where you can't see the ground from the sky because it's all just swirled together. That's the kind of setting this is, and it really captured the realism, the neorealism of it. I think it's probably the best acted one too, maybe the one with the soldier and the prostitute, because that's just two people, but this, for the majority, the amount of people in it, was pretty well acted. And I'm such a fucking snob, that always takes me out.
I hear you. That to me was like part of the dreariness, I think, is that like the non-professional acting is bad.
Yeah.
And it's not like, okay, well, non-professional acting, of course it's bad. Hello, what did we watch in Bicycle Thief? What did we watch in every fucking Robert Bresson film? We saw great acting by non-professional actors. It felt like Rossellini kind of exposed them, some of the non-professionals, a little too much in a way that some of the, you know, like De Sica or Bresson wouldn't. It's just sort of like, here you go. Let's all stand around and exchange dialogue together.
Yeah.
And it's just like, no, that's what real actors do, dude. No,
To be fair to Rossellini in this, he is intentionally having an American speak to an Italian.
Yeah.
And so there's the non-acting portion. Then there's also the, like, I don't even know what the fuck, like, they're saying.
What even is this?
Yeah. So I'm going to react however I'm going to react.
Absolutely.
But yeah. It was my favorite segment, but man, dreary as fuck. Mm-hmm. Los Olvidados, come and see. These are endings that were just slightly happier than this one.
Yeah. Yeah, because like Boom Boom, the Americans get killed, all the bodies are dumped in the river, and then the narration comes on and it actually says, this happened in the winter of 1944. By the spring, the war was over. And it's just like, how fucking meaningless was all of this, right? Like, the war is over, and yet still people are getting slaughtered. It's horrifying. Horrifying stuff. Yeah. So that's Paisan. Quirky, any scenes, favorite moment, performance, anything you want to talk about that we didn't get to
discuss? Like in the last segment, it stuck with me that they ate eels. Like, these are people living off whatever they can scavenge,
right,
out of the river where they're stuck in.
They
had eels, and they had to duck German soldiers whenever they could. The next time you see them, they're all massacred. There's just a child left screaming, and it's rough stuff, but that was probably the life for these partisans. That's the life they chose. They're like, no, we're not laying down. We're going to fight.
Absolutely. Yeah. No. Heroic stuff.
How about you?
But the movie's not really about heroism.
No.
In a way, right? Yeah. Boy, about me. I would say I think episode 3 was kind of underrated. Again, I mentioned how it's pretty similar to Waterloo Bridge, and maybe speaks to a little more of where Rossellini is headed with his career, more than where he is in his career at this point. But I did think it was a pretty beautiful, kind of sad, tragic love story, and yeah, I do appreciate those. So yeah, I'll give a little bit of dap to that, and to the acting in there, which is I think easily the best acting in the entire
In all,
any of the episodes. They're both very good, both the soldier and the prostitute are both very good. All right, Quirky, well, it is that time, although I think we've telegraphed it pretty well, but you know, there's paperwork to be done, so let's make this official. Of course, we rate every movie on the sight or sound. If we both think that it was a sound selection and is one of the greatest films ever made, then kaboom, the cannons roar, and right into the cannon fodder cannon it goes. 50 strong, I do believe, at this point, the cannon fodder cannon, give or take. If one or both of us think it was a little slight, not bad necessarily, maybe very good, but just not in the canon, then fizzle. No cannons roar, no cannon fodder cannon for you, but we will offer up a slighted movie, not in the sight and town top 250 to put in its place. Quirky,
yeah.
Eyes on, slight or sound?
Ooh, it's slight. It's not making the canon for me.
Yeah. Nope.
Good movie. You should watch Enjoyable, even though it's dark.
If you're interested in World War II, if you're interested in neorealist cinema, yeah, if you're interested in that area of Italian history or Italian cinema, then it's a must watch, absolutely. And if you're just interested in classic film in general, it's a must watch. But I do agree that it is just a little slight for my taste, and while I liked it quite a bit, and it keeps growing in estimation the more that we've talked about it and the more that I've thought about it. Yeah, I got to go slight as well. But Quirky, that just means we should have two movies to offer up in its place. So I'll put it to you first. What slighted movie would you substitute in the Sight and Sound Top 250 for Paisan?
So I'm going with the movie from just about a decade later. It's not a war movie, but it is a fighting movie, and it takes place in the same area, up and down Italy. It is the 1960 Stanley Kubrick movie Spartacus, starring Kirk Douglas as Spartacus. But then, hey, everybody's Spartacus by the end of this fucking thing, right? It's pretty long. It is a sit. But Dalton Trumbo did a good screenplay on this one, and it looks amazing. Kubrick, Sword and Sandals, give me a break. It's really fucking good, and it won a lot of awards, and you get to see Ustinov and Olivier, height of their powers, just going for it.
What a strode.
Kirk Douglas is sweaty and chiseled and got a butt chin. What more do you need?
Don't forget. Yeah, Spartacus. Seen it several times. Wow. Canon worthy. Gosh. I mean, it's really close for me. I might have to...
You're going to have to do a revisit?
I might have to revisit. It's just like I've seen it a couple of times. I don't think I've seen it since... Because like it really famously was restored.
Yeah.
And re-released like when we were pretty young. Late 80s, early 90s, I think. And I remember seeing it a couple of times back in those days, but it's been at least like a quarter of a century, so I would love to see it again. My initial thought is like, well, I'm actually torn. This is why I can't do it. I love the movie. It's great. Of course it's a canon film. And then I think like, but boy, there's like 8 better Stanley Kubrick movies that we don't have in our canon right now. So the optics of it, Quirky, the optics.
There are...
So I'll go back, I'll revisit it, and I will give a more informed opinion that is not will not be tinged by nostalgia.
Don't the Archers have like 11 on this fucking list?
Oh, right. Yes,
so
they sure do.
We'll just take out like half of theirs.
We'll get that. Yeah, that's no fair. Well, that's a great pick. A fantastic pick. Absolutely. And I will rewatch Spartacus hopefully before the end of the year. We can talk about it on our year-end show.
Right on.
December. I also have a selection. It is not on the Sight and Sound Top 250. And as I said about Paisan, what I appreciated most was really the severity of it, like the bleakness, the brutality, the bitterness, the sort of like snatching defeat from the jaws of victoryness of it all. Again, especially since it is a story of victories, at least on a superficial sort of a globo geopolitical sort of a level. But I tell you, Quirky, it looks almost polite next to my pick. Fires on the Plain, 1959 Japanese film by the great Kon Ichikawa. Like Paisan, also set in the waning days of World War II, although this time we're following a soldier on the losing side. One of the members, a private in the Japanese Imperial Army. It's set on the Philippine island of Leyte in early 1945, just as the Allies are beginning to liberate. Our hero is Private Tomura, who is diagnosed with tuberculosis as the film opens and is essentially left behind by his company and told to blow himself up with a grenade if he can't get help. So our hero is marked for death just as the movie is beginning, and the film is really about his not at all inspiring story of survival through just the most horrifying conditions you can possibly. I mean, being a Japanese private with tuberculosis, left alone in the middle of the jungle while everyone wants to kill you, including the Filipinos who are there as well. And after seeing the destruction caused by the atom bomb, the director Kon Ichikawa, he set out to make just the bleakest, darkest, most disturbing, most horrifying war movie he could make. And he nailed it. Like, it is not a fun watch at all, but like Mirror, it is powerful. Very, very powerful, kind of soul-rattling kind of stuff. Ichikawa is one of the great under-heralded world directors. One of the great Japanese directors of all time, and he is nowhere to be found on this Sight and Sound list. And this is not his only good film. He made The Burmese Harp, which also could have gone on this list as well, and Actor's Revenge, and Conflagration, and Odd Obsession, and Tokyo Olympiad. He's an absolute genius, and this is his best film, I think, Fires on the Plain. Awesome. And if you want to see it, it's on Criterion Channel. Canopy as well has it for free with your library card. So it's if you like to come and see, check out Fires on the Plain.
Also, if you like to come and see, check on yourself, okay?
Check on,
that's not a movie to like.
It's
appreciate, share, hey, celebrate even.
Or canonize.
Canonize? I like that movie.
No, I mean, I think it's one of the great films of all time, but it's also like movies I'd never want to watch ever again at the same time. Come and See is, that's the gold standard as far as just like nightmare fuel. But this is a pretty intense, potent film as well. But it is quite beautiful also, the black and white cinematography. But also, boy, I guess the actors really, like people were really, really devoted to making this movie to the point that they were killing themselves. You know, it was like, people was just like, no one was allowed to comb their hair. No one was allowed to clean their fingernails or do, you know what I mean? Like the lead actor barely ate for several months. So, I mean, it's a really, really potent, powerful film.
Well, it may surprise you, but I have not seen it. But I am very interested in it. You did a good job selling, sir.
It's what I do, Quirky.
So that's what we thought about Paisan. What did you think about Paisan? Had you seen it? Did you watch it with us? Please share what you thought of it. We'd love to hear your take. Contact us on Facebook and Instagram at Dear Daniel Pod. Tell us all your thoughts.
But now it is that very special time of the show where we will randomly select the movie to review in 2 weeks on our next episode. So let's summon out those random number generator gods. You ready for this, Quirky?
Let's go, baby.
Praise Jeebus, what do you got? We've got Quirky. No, that's the wrong list. That is also the wrong list. We've got Quirky Metropolis. This is the 1927 Fritz Lang silent film famous movie. You know it even if you don't know
it,
just because it has been copied and homaged in just about any science fiction film, any movie that is about the future. I will read you the synopsis from Letterboxd. In a futuristic city sharply divided between the rich and the poor, the son of the city's mastermind meets a prophet who predicts the coming of a savior to mediate their differences. Quirky, have you ever seen Metropolis?
No, but I'm very, very familiar with the imagery from it.
Absolutely. Yeah, the special effects here, groundbreaking, probably still groundbreaking. And then just, of course, the social commentary going on as well. Fritz Lang, an amazing director guy. I mean, like, I'm excited to talk about Fritz Lang, his story of basically, like, being there at the advent of German Expressionism, but he was also, like, a really fantastic Hollywood genre filmmaker as well.
Oh, cool.
So excited to talk about Fritz and his career. Excited to talk about Metropolis, which is a movie I've not seen in decades. Now, if you want to see it, it is pretty widely available, 1927, so it's in the public domain. You know, anything 95 plus 1 years old is in the public domain. So on just about any site that has free streaming or ads-based streaming, you can find it. It's on Tubi, it's on Canopy, it's on Plex, it's on Pluto TV and the Roku channel and Flix Fling and Fubo and Shmoobo and Gibbity Gib Gib Gib.
Oh, I love that one.
It's on all of them, yeah, right? And if you don't want any of those, you can rent it as well on any of your streaming services. I will say it's one of those movies where a lot of different cuts exist, shorter cuts, mm-hmm. longer cuts. The official cut seems to be 153 minutes. So accept no substitutes is my advice to you. So join us in 2 weeks, and we will be reviewing Metropolis.
Until then, follow Dear Daniel Pod on Facebook and Instagram. Like and rate us on your favorite podcast app, please. If you'd like to donate to the show, visit DearDaniel.com. Find support the show in the menu or look for the donate button. For Cannon Fodder, I'm Corky McDonald.
And I'm Daniel Barnes, and save us a seat in the back row.